Good afternoon. It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and you are listening to Dialogue here on WUOT Knoxville. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Our guests today are Dean Rifkin, Distinguished Professor of Law here at the University of Tennessee, and Brenda McGee, Children's Rights Attorney here in Knoxville. We'll also be taking your calls. Today on Dialogue, we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. Minors who end up in court because of so-called status offenses like smoking or truancy or violating curfews, all of those non-criminal actions, and then they end up before a judge, often without any access to counsel at all. I'd like to say good afternoon to our guests, Dean Rifkin and Brenda McGee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chrissy.
Thank you so much for being here today. Why don't you introduce yourselves, and then we'll start talking.
I'm Brenda McGee. I'm an attorney here in Knoxville. I've been practicing for over 30 years for children's rights, and for the last 5 years, I've been the pro bono community cooperating attorney with the UT Education Law Practicum.
Okay.
And I'm Dean Rifkin. I've been a member of the College of Law faculty since 1976. I've been a clinical teacher. I've taught courses in what's called public interest lawyering. Brenda and I both have an almost 30-year history of representing children who have been denied their educational rights, whether those be special education rights, whether they be the right to alternative education. Our goal throughout all the years of this practice has been to keep kids in school and out of court. And we can explain more about that. 5 years ago, I created a course at the law school for law students, a clinical course called Public Interest Lawyering, the Education Law Practicum. And the practicum took on the representation of a selected number of students in the Knox County schools who were, as you noted before, being prosecuted for the status or unruly offense of truancy. Mm-hmm. We had not encountered this issue in all the years of prior law practice that we've done. We were asked to come in and see what the situation was like, and when we did, we saw a problem of local magnitude, a problem of statewide magnitude, and now, literally, in the 5 years we've been in the practicum, a problem that is gaining national attention, and we're plugged into all of those levels.
Yeah, it's across the U.S., it's a problem that's being written about in every state. I mean, Texas, especially, in California, these are big states where the schools have these rules that, you know, if you break a rule, then you're suspended from school and sometimes expelled from school. Let me go back to something you said, Dean, about public interest law.
Right.
Education obviously falls under that umbrella.
Absolutely.
What else kind of falls
under
that?
Public interest lawyering encompasses a number of fields. For example, I teach courses at the law school in environmental law. And there are a number of public interest environmental law firms around the country. There are also a number of juvenile rights nonprofit organizations around the country. There are education law nonprofits. This is a stratum of legal practice that many of our students say they want to enter when they come to law school because they want to make a difference. And public interest lawyering gives them that opportunity. And one of the most gratifying parts of the practicum that we've seen with the 10 students each year who have been part of it is many of them have gone on to jobs of the kind that I just described. And we like to think that the experience they had in the practicum gave them a boost with that goal.
Can you tell me a little bit about the practicum, Brenda?
What does it involve?
Well, let me add to what Dean just said about these students, because I think that's been the most satisfying part of this work, is that if they don't go into a practice of public interest, and there are very few opportunities these days for that to be a possibility, they go away with a sensitivity to an issue that really is below the radar screen of clients and families caught up in bureaucratic issues that they don't know how to get themselves out of, and which is perfect for legal intervention, except for the economic restrictions that pro bono representation can address. And that's one of the concerns that we're the most involved with, is bringing to a practice of unrepresented youth in the courts the need for the community to step up and make themselves available to consult with these families, to represent these families, to be their representatives if they go forward into a prosecution by the state.
How much does the practicum work with area school systems?
We are representing clients in school meetings all the time. And when I say school meetings, many of them are meetings relating to special education matters. For example, seeking an evaluation of a student who we learned by looking at records had a long history of mental health care and problems, who was then ultimately prosecuted for not going to school. We see students like this. We know the federal special education law, IDEA. We go to school meetings and we request, as is the right of parents, an evaluation to determine if, in fact, the student is entitled to eligibility and services, either under what's called IDEA or Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, an anti-discrimination law. And once those students are placed under that umbrella, which many of our clients have been, once we were able to get involved and educate the parents about what that means, there is a whole layer of protection to keep kids in school and to tailor an education program that is going to ensure that they do that, or ensure that they have an exit from school, a good exit that will take them to whatever next step they're going to do. So we go to school meetings all the time like that. We have gone to school disciplinary hearings where clients were accused of violating school rules for one reason or another. There is no right to counsel there, but we have been quite successful in those hearings in showing that our client, in one way or another, either didn't violate the rule or should not receive a suspension or an expulsion. So we work, I have to say, very closely in many ways with the school system and the key people in the school system who run student services. And ever since we started the practicum, we have been in a dialogue with them and sending them information, especially about truancy reform, because the dimensions of that problem when we started representing students in 2009 was pretty significant. Let me give you some facts and figures if I can. Mm-hmm. In Tennessee, in just 2012, there were 9,634 juvenile court petitions filed for truancy.
Wow.
That was one of 26,247 status offense or unruly offense petitions. Now, what is a status offense? In Tennessee, it's called unruly. It is only an offense because the child or the youth is under 18. And as you said before, it encompasses truancy. It encompasses an offense called runaway. It encompasses offense that is...
See, I didn't even know that was an offense.
Oh, yes.
Runaway.
Runaway child is potentially a status offender.
Wow.
So the dimensions of this problem, and this 9,600 figure for 2012, the latest figures, has been consistent over over the decade in Tennessee.
Oh, every year it's about that same number?
It's been about that same number for the entire counting period starting in 2002. So this is a problem because, as you noted before, when a child is petitioned into juvenile court for a status offense, they are not entitled to an attorney, and these numbers are quite big. The other statistic that I think is important to discuss is that when we started this project in 2009, there were 179 petitions for truancy, for example, reported in Knox County. The latest figures that are out for 2013 show that there were 26 petitions filed, which is approximately an 85% reduction in the number of petitions filed in that 5 years. There are a lot of people who should get credit for that reduction, because that means that kids are getting what they need in school without resort to a juvenile court that doesn't have the resources, doesn't have the expertise that the school system and other community agencies have to provide the services and interventions that are needed. We have found, and I'm saying this in all self-candor, we have found that to navigate that system, parents need an attorney.
Yeah.
Because it's a complicated system.
Yeah, just trying to read about it is complicated. I can't imagine actually having a child involved.
Well, let me give you an example of that of truancy.
Yeah.
I think most people would say, well, if the kid isn't going to school, they're truant. Well, that's not legally true. The law says that you're unruly as a student with chronic absences without justification. Well, what's a justification? And when you talk to parents, and what we found with all of these, they had no idea that there was any defense to the fact that their child was missing school. It's the justification part that I think is important to address, because the why a kid doesn't go to school is a serious matter, since education is so important. And I think the assumptions are that, well, it's a bad kid or it's a bad mother. And that hasn't been our finding at all in these 5 years with the kids that we've represented in the families. The prominent problem we have found in lack of attendance problems, because they're not truant. They're not going to school. That's the reality. They're not going to school because of mental health issues that are either undiagnosed or untreated.
That's most often, you said?
That's okay. The biggest reason that we have found. The national statistics and again, what we've found in our 5 years is mirrored in a dialogue that's going on nationally. Bullying is a major concern of schools and communities and families, and kids are smart. They don't go to school if they're getting beat up. And again, finding out what's going on is not as easy as you would think. A school, why don't they know what's going on? A lot of reasons. There's a shame factor involved, we've found. There's an inability of speaking to power bureaucrats or school people. There is sometimes a lack of sensitivity. There's sometimes a lack of even opportunity. A couple of things. We have learned that with cell phones, people have phones, but they may not have a lot of talking minutes. They may have more texting minutes. Well, the assumption is they didn't call me back. So why didn't they call me back? We've worked with other school districts that recognize that you text these people and they get back to you in text. That's just an interesting idea. With making assumptions that aren't born true. Another issue was, well, if your kid is sick, take them to the doctor and bring us a report.
Right.
If you can't get to the doctor, you can't do that. And that we found out that, well, a lot of our clients are on 10 care. They can get 10 care transportation. Well, none of them had any idea that they had the right to request 10 care transportation within a 3-hour block. They were told when we got started that they could either call an ambulance or they could wait 3 days. Well, that's just that's not going to work. We had students. We said this just can't be true. There was research done. There was advocacy done. We learned that indeed 10 care does provide called urgent care transportation same day with a 3-hour notice. And of course, this allows families that obviously care about their children's illness to get to some health service. Those are things that they didn't know. The court didn't know. The school didn't know.
I didn't know.
We didn't know either.
Obviously, 10 care patients didn't know. That's
indeed
crazy.
I think one thing that we encountered when we began this practice, and as I said, we have had a long history of representing at-risk children, but we had never done it in the context of unruly or status offenses, much less truancy. The received narrative, as they say, was, and we kept hearing this, parents don't care, kids lay out, it's a parent or a child problem. And that's the received and been the received narrative until very recently, sort of nationally. Mm-hmm. Instead, what has happened, and we think there's sort of a tipping point coming nationally, and that is that received narrative has been replaced by a narrative that says, let's look at the underlying causes and see what is keeping a kid from going to school. That could be a failure on the part of the school to provide what's necessary. And all around the country, there is this effort to require school systems to do a better job early. And we think Knox County has started to do that and is doing that because of the number of petitions now being so small.
That have dropped. Let's take a break real quick, and then I want to come back and we're going to talk about some of these the success stories and talk about what the practicum does and also talk about how it is that these kids and like take a case sample and how does the child, you know, end up in the court.
Sure.
So you're listening to Dialogue on WUOT Knoxville. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. My guests today are Dean Rifkin and Brenda McGee. Our phone number is 974-5050. If you have a question or a comment for our guests, please call us at 974-5050.
A tight race for a U.S. Senate seat has Republicans in Colorado working to win over Latino voters in some cities.
And although it's heavily Democrat, when we look at values, when we look at who we are, especially as Hispanics, our values tend to be conservative.
Immigration, economics, and the fight for control of the Senate. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join your host Paula Coleman today at 4 for All Things Considered on WUOT.
You're back with us. Dialogue here on WUOT Knoxville 91.9 FM. My guests today are Dean Rifkin and Brenda McGee. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. We're talking about the prison school-to-prison pipeline across the country here in the U.S. Children, school-age children who commit what are called unruly offenses here in Tennessee, truancy, runaway, which we'll get to in just a moment, who end up in a courtroom without a lawyer before a judge, often having no idea what to do. So I'd like to thank Dean and Brenda for being here today. They both help run the Education Law Practicum at the UT College of Law. And Brenda, you said before the break that you wanted to specifically focus on runaways. And let's get to that, because as I said when we first began the show, I had no idea that a child could actually be held, that it was an offense to run away, you know?
Well, me either. I didn't know anything about all of these non-crimes being prosecuted without lawyers. I think the general theme for status offenders is to be aware, to wonder, and to be curious, and to ask why. Because these are non-crimes. Why are these kids doing this? And we've not focused very much in the practicum on runaways, but the numbers are high. And the lockups of runaways is high at the detention center, or has been in the past. And there's a national voice around runaways, very concerned about trafficking and abuse. Mm-hmm. If you're not, and we in Knox County do not have a secure place for these runaways to be taken. And the national discussion is, if a runaway is being trafficked or is being abused and running away, I guess all runaways are running from something. You need to, as an adult, as a community, you need to know why. You can believe that if you put them in a squad car and take them to a detention center, they're not going to tell you why. You need a safe, nurturing, secure place of non-punitive people, scary people, for you to begin to believe that somebody cares. And if the risk of identifying trafficked girls or abused children is what you're all about, we need to have this place. And Knoxville just closed. We just got a shelter closed in Knox County. We don't have that place. That's an important thing to the practicum. That's an important issue that we're going to look into more.
Oh, that's good. Okay. I'm thinking, you know, that the justice system in this country, or any country for that matter, wasn't really set up for children.
Juvenile courts were set up in the early part of the 1900s on the premise that juvenile courts were going to be sort of the kindly, paternalistic force to rehabilitate children, to, correct their behavior. What happened was, over time, the juvenile court became more like a regular court, which meant that there was a more punitive sort of aspect to the juvenile court. Whether it be for delinquency offenders or whether it be for status offenders, the same was true. In the late 60s, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called In re Galt, called the juvenile court out for its lax procedures, for its use of discretion or abuse of discretion, and said in delinquency cases, a child needs counsel, a child needs regular procedure. There needs to be some regularity rather than the kind of unchecked discretion that was characteristic. This has always been true of the neglected corner of juvenile justice, and that is the status offense system. That kind of discretion, frankly, that kind of unaccountability has harmed the system, as families and children come into a system where, one, they don't understand and what the system is all about. Two, they don't know how to navigate it. And frankly, what we saw with our clients is once they were in the system, they were tethered to that system for hearing after hearing, year after year without evidence that they were getting the kind of services and programs and interventions and whatever was needed to make sure that they were kept in school and not in court. And the evidence nationally has been unanimous in recent years that court involvement, in fact, can exacerbate these problems as opposed to solving them.
How did these status offenses end up in a courtroom instead of, and being almost equated to delinquency offenses, instead of just going to a different branch,
like a social work branch,
or right. even an augmented, part of the education, the district, the school district?
How this is a happen? Really good question, Chrissy. It's a question that has plagued scholars and commentators about the juvenile court over the years. There was a very highly respected judge in the 70s who said, juvenile courts exercise jurisdiction over status offenses because they can. And because they can, they're relieving the agencies that really are supposed to solve these problems of the urgency in doing so. How did that sort of creep in jurisdiction occur? Lots of speculation or lots of expert sort of reasons for it. And every state, you're right, has been different. But the stark reality is that there are close to 130,000 status offense petitions filed nationwide. 50,000 of those, for example, are truancy. And if you look at the numbers, and we're very skeptical, if Tennessee had 9,600 in 2013 and there were 50,000 filed nationally, either Tennessee's numbers are awfully high or the 50,000 number is an undercount. And there are organizations that are working on trying to figure out what the data is, because data can drive the resolution to this problem, and it's not there.
Who files the petition?
When we got started, the truancy petitions were filed by the school system. Midway in our work and after a lawsuit that we filed, the police filed these petitions now.
Right.
So the police are involved from the beginning?
For now, with truancy.
Wow.
The police are signing the petitions. We're still unclear what they know about the defendant, the juvenile who is part of this petition, but the idea of the school system itself filing the petition, coming to court, and it's very important to know that the state, the DA, who is in the courtroom virtually all the time in truancy cases, has the burden of proving by what's called clear and convincing evidence that the child in fact is unruly. And when we started, then the child went to a probation officer who was also a school system employee. That's changed for the better, but it's a system that was designed not to look inward, basically, as to what was the ultimate cause, the real cause of why a student was habitually absent. Remember, everybody in this system wants students to succeed in school.
Right.
And the question is, how do you create a process where that happens? And it's gotten, in our 5 years, a lot better here in Knox County. Statewide, it's should be getting better, because the Tennessee State Board of Education has created rules at long last on attendance. They were told by the legislature to create these regulations, they're called, almost 20 years ago. And when we were researching this question, our law students, they came across the fact that the Tennessee State Board of Education had a mandate from the legislature to create rules that school systems could and should follow for children and who were absent. We approached the Tennessee State Board of Education, and we said we think these rules would go a long way toward improving the truancy numbers in the state, which are very high. There are, by technical definition, 260,000 students who are, quote, denominated truant in the state. Many of those have missed 3 or 5 days, but that's the definition.
So if they've missed any school at all,
well,
do they fall into that, or only if a
quote,
petition is
filed? Unexcused days.
Each
school system, frankly, we learned, have slightly different ways of counting what unexcused means. The Board of Education did pass these rules. They're going to go into effect this fall. And these rules say to school systems, hey, you've got to set up intervention early and intensive and give parents a meaningful opportunity to explain and students what really is going on. And we have great hope for that that system if it's implemented meaningfully. And we think Knox County has been at the forefront of doing that even without the rules over the last couple of years.
Now, so will those rules streamline the way that all school districts in the state report absences, or?
I think it's going to open up more possibilities for school systems to look deeper into why kids are absent. Instead of it encourages schools to consider other, I think the word is exigencies, why the kids are absent, instead of just a short list. I think Knox County's short list of unexcused absences is a medical problem with a note, a death with an obituary. I think there are two more that I'm not coming up with. These excuses have nothing to do with the basis of chronic absences. Chronic absences we define as an absence that a child cannot fix. The chronic absent kid is absent because he can't fix what's wrong with either the bullying or the mental health or the homelessness or the serious illness of a parent, this sort of thing. So I think these regulations recognize that there these issues that was certainly talked about in committee. A lot of people agree on these justifications for chronic absences, and I think school systems are going to be more able to deal with that. The other big piece of the reg is an appeal process at the school level.
Oh, okay.
And I think that will also help parents who don't feel like they have the opportunity to explain what's going on in the home at the school level. There'll be an independent person in the appeal process to listen to them. That we hope that will make a big difference.
And we're very proud of our law students' role in seeing these regulations come into being. We had 6 law students go to Nashville a couple of years ago to make a presentation to the State Board of Education on why these rules were not only legally mandated, but also were the right thing to do in an era where there needs to be more accountability, better attendance, better exits. And our law students, you know, did a fabulous job of educating everybody about a problem that, as you note, is sort of and as I mentioned before, a neglected corner of this intersection between schools and courts, frankly.
Just completely in the dark. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, like I said, I didn't know until May when I spoke to Susan Ferris at the Center for Public Integrity that this was even going on,
right?
Regardless of it being in Tennessee. I mean, I didn't even know it happened in the U.S. And then all of a sudden, you know, nobody knows. It's amazing.
It's a very much, you know, under the radar system. And it's especially under the radar in states like Tennessee that don't provide a right to counsel. There is a right to counsel in a relatively small number of states. Other states don't provide counsel. And then there are a few states that don't take these cases to court, but instead have a system of early intervention and a system of the kind that we've been describing,
right,
that ensures that the students are served and you know, and the best program to keep them in school. We have to say that one thing we've seen in the last 5 years, and one thing we've been advocating strongly, is that there needs to be less of one size fits all for students who are chronically absent, and there needs to be a diversity of opportunities for these students. That diversity can include alternative education. It can include distance-based sort of education in those circumstances where that makes sense. It can include a modified program. It certainly can include special education where that's implicated and called for. One of the biggest issues we've worked on is early on, we saw a number of students who had virtually no credits and they were juniors. They were simply not going to graduate. And one of the things we looked into was, what's the best exit for this student? And we looked into GED programs, and we found that the law allowed students to enroll in a GED program at 17. 18 is the age in Tennessee of compulsory education. And we have directed a number of students to very good GED programs here in the community that educate students toward that exit, if you will. And of course, GED programs have gotten a whole lot more credibility over the last 5 years as a route to community college or a route to the workplace. Mm-hmm. And it's those alternatives, bringing them, surfacing them, bringing them out in the open and making them available, that we think is gonna keep these numbers down.
The number is 974-5050, 974-5050, if you have a question or a comment for either Dean Rifkind or Brenda McGee or myself. We are talking about the so-called school-to-prison pipeline today, and we're going to take a real quick break. This is Dialogue on WUOT 91.9 FM.
I'm Aaron Allen. Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney. Next time on To The Point, new abortion restrictions were set to go into effect this week in Louisiana and Texas, but federal judges have temporarily blocked them for different reasons. Texas has appealed, Louisiana likely will too. Is the state-by-state battle likely to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 on WUOT2.
Thank you for tuning into Dialogue here on WUOT 974-5050. That's the number to call if you have a question or a comment. We have Lena on the phone from Sevierville. Lena, are you there? Lena, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, now I can hear you. What's your question?
My question is, let's say you have a student who's suffering from a mental illness like depression, and that can definitely impact their attendance in school. What sort of services are available for a student now if they're having a truancy issue, and what sort of services are you guys hoping maybe will be available to them in the future?
Oh, great question, Lena. Thanks for the call. All right, let's
good question.
Let's answer that one.
This is Brenda. We have had many clients who couldn't go to school because of their depression, quit going to school because of undiagnosed or untreated or misunderstood And once we found that out, it's not hard to interview a child and not figure out depression is happening if they trust you and you can actually interview the child. And we think that's the most important thing. Certainly, our clients, we have gotten them into treatment. Many of them are on medication. The most important thing we think of as lawyers is to reintroduce our clients to the agencies that they're working with and for the schools or the courts, to let those agencies know who they're dealing with now. If the child's depression is impacting the education to the extent that they're not able to come to school that much, I would assume evaluations under the two federal statutes. Two of our clients, one of our clients who was extraordinarily depressed and quite anxious never did walk back in a school building, but the school system under the IDEA and accommodations worked with this student in a library and worked with the student in the home and also worked with the student in a an educational building that was not a school, and she graduated. So accommodating, if our intent is to understand the child, not blame anybody, and provide them with education, it can be done.
This is a really good question, because childhood depression and mental health issues are still very much under the radar, despite evidence that they are quite common. And how those issues are confronted by a family and by ultimately a school system, if the student is missing a lot of school, it is not an easy proposition, but it's a worthwhile proposition to confront them, because, as Brenda said, there are any number of mechanisms, accommodations that are available to take into account this student's condition, to work with this student, and ultimately to see this student stabilized and, we hope, reengaged and going back to school.
And many more options than there used to be. I mean, as far as, even just as far as mental health goes, I mean, there's access to help, there's access to medication for as far as the schools go. I mean, as you said, alternative online schools in another building altogether. Yeah.
Well, and the stigma is also diminishing considerably. And I think that's one of the most important things, is that the discrimination against disabilities are the unseen disabilities, the mental disabilities that are not seen and sometimes not believed. That kind of discrimination is lessening more and more and more as we educate people.
And hand in hand with depression has been a lot of research on what has been called school aversion. Students who have, a condition that raises their anxiety, raises their depression when they are confronted with the prospect of going to school. There's been a lot of psychological and psychiatric research on this in recent years. As Brenda said, it is not a slackered kid who is not going to school. And how to deal with that, whether it be through therapy, whether it be through medication, whether it be through very incremental steps to reengage the student into school. There are protocols and practices, best practices, that can be brought to bear to do that.
Absolutely. Let's take another call. We have June on the phone from West Knoxville. June, go ahead.
Yes, I want to make a quick comment just on education generally in the United States. We're 32 in math, but the main reason is we have some horribly high number, 20% of non-English speaking first graders. So your schools are full of kids that are first generation whose parents don't speak English, and that disrupts the entire system. So the teachers get tied up with foreign-born students, and then the Native Americans get way behind. But I guess then my question is, what percentage of the people you're working with now are foreign-born or children of first-generation people or non-English speakers? And you could kind of lump it all together.
That's an interesting question. Thanks for the call.
Yep, thank you. Bye.
Interestingly enough, I think we can say the problem probably is more pronounced as these immigrant children are older because of the language. It's more difficult to learn. I think early learners, first grade students, I've been in the classroom with them. They pick up English very, very quickly. Right now we're dealing with, in the practicum, our students are working with two young middle school and high school brothers from Guatemala. And because they're older and they speak an indigenous language, I think the school is going to struggle with how to bring these kids into the educational process, and they may have to go to alternative programming.
You know, this is a good question, because yes, there is a mandate on school systems for English language learning, or what that entails, and I think the way we think about it is, in a way, pay me now or pay me later. If these children who are recent immigrants don't get the kind of education and services that they need and work for them, where are they going to go? And that's going to be important to this country as more and more people in this country are from other countries recently. So good question. Mm-hmm. Real challenge for the school system, but it can be done.
Let's take one more call. We've got Bruce on the line from Knoxville. Bruce.
Yes, I was wondering, you mentioned about the funding. Where are the funds for these children, these young people? Are they federal, state, or local, or some combination?
Okay, great question. Thanks for the call, Bruce.
It's a combination. Good question. The federal government funds a certain percentage, relatively small, of special education, somewhere in the vicinity of 12 to 15%. The state funds part of that, and then local school systems are obligated under federal law to fund the rest. And that funding is there. It's never fully adequate. Everyone concedes that, but it's definitely a combination.
Well, you know, we've come around to, we're almost done. I mean, we just have about 5 minutes left, and I'm feeling a little more positive than I was at the beginning of the hour, which I didn't expect. But something I realized during the last call is that, as you said, there have been many improvements, and not just improvements, but school systems are changing. They've made big changes over the last 50 years. I mean, just in the last 20 years, they've made huge changes as the population grows more diverse, as some of these mental health problems are dealt with in a more comprehensive manner. Lots of different reasons. So it sounds like, you know, the community is becoming involved. There are more people who are sort of have their hands in the pie, and it might actually get better for students.
I think we are definitely on the road. The numbers in juvenile court, and that's our concern, is keep the kid out of court and solve the problem at home, in the community, in the school, with collaboration amongst the three. When kids go into the court system, it's just not a good system for kids that don't commit crimes, and the numbers are down. I also think with the numbers, again, to say that to sensitize students who are going to be community attorneys in the next year or 2 or 3 years is the way to change things. And then to educate the community, like this program, we are trying to use Know Your Rights pamphlets to the community about juvenile court policies and practices and the need to know your rights. These things, I think, are making a big difference, and we want those numbers to come down even more.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. There's been progress. But I want to emphasize, we've been dealing with only one corner of this phenomenon that you called and other people are calling school-to-prison pipeline.
Right.
There are other aspects of practices and policies that are part of that pipeline other than unruly offenses. Disproportionate school discipline, for example. When I say disproportionate, falling much more heavily on African-American students or students
or
with disabilities
and,
Latino
right,
students.
Right.
Same with school-based arrests. The data is there to show that that is a problem. And this is for minor misconduct. It's not for major sort of delinquency. So there are other corners of this problem, if you will, that deserve much attention. And we're shifting in the practicum slowly with our law students toward looking at some of those corners and seeing if there's legal remedies for doing better.
I'll be interested to hear about that. So besides that coming up with the practicum, do you have an end date on this, or this is an ongoing project?
This is a course that has been ongoing since 2009. And when I say ongoing, this course doesn't end for us and for many of our students, you know, with the end of the semester. We work year-round because our clients have those needs, and, you know, we are going to continue down this path because it's a tremendous learning experience for law students, and we think it serves the community well.
Any last words before we finish up here? Anything else we want to say about the school, especially to parents who have children in school or anyone who's dealing with an...
Well, I certainly think it's the right thing to do to sit down with the school system and explain what's going on with your child and expect them to listen and to understand a lot more than they possibly did years ago of what's going on and what they can do to work with the family to make sure that these kids are educated. And it may not be in the classroom. It may not... And to open up the possibility that we need to, as they say, let's work outside the box on this. We've graduated kids, as I said, out of the library. We've educated kids with meltdown plans.
What do you mean by meltdown, real quick?
with mental health issues.
Oh,
that,
okay. Gotcha.
We've seen graduation through GED programs.
Bullying plans.
Bullying, protective plans. We've actually have gotten protective order for a child in school when the school system needed, when the bullying didn't stop. That's very important for this child to have that kind of protection.
Yeah, we didn't have anything like that when I was in school.
Well, this is new.
Yeah.
You know, again, things can be done if you just sit down and start talking about it and get the disciplines working.